Welcome to Hard Talk on the BBC World Service with me, Stephen Sacker. My guest today works in a field of academic research which arouses interest far beyond the campus lecture theatre. Professor Laurie Santos is a psychologist at Yale University, and her special subject in recent years has been happiness. Back in 2018, she noticed that mental health issues, stress, anxiety, depression, even suicidal thoughts seemed to be on the rise among students at Yale. She decided to develop a course on the science of happiness. It proved to be the most popular elective course in Yale's history. And that was before the impact of the COVID pandemic made discussion of mental health an even hotter topic around the world. Now, Professor Santos reaches an audience of millions with her free online course on the science of well-being and her podcast on the same subject. Ultimately, all of us surely hope for a good and meaningful life, but is happiness something we can learn? Well, Laurie Santos joins me now from New Haven, Connecticut. Welcome to Hard Talk.
Thanks so much for having me.
Would it be right for me to say that you have made it your mission, particularly in this time of COVID, your mission to teach us all how to be happier?
Yeah, I think that's one way to put it. I mean, one of the things we learn from the research is that we have pretty bad intuitions when it comes to the kinds of things that will make us happy. And that means that even in challenging times like this, a lot of us are working on our own happiness. We're working on our own mental health, but we're kind of doing it the wrong way. We're going after the wrong things.
What are we going after that's wrong?
Well, one of the biggest misconceptions is that we need to change our circumstances, right? We need to, you know, get more money or change our job or buy something, right? And I think what the research really shows is that if you look at people who are going through tough times, it's not always the case that tough times mean unhappiness. You can look to people who've had like really devastating circumstances, you know, like loss of their limbs, you know, losing their jobs, you know, just like the kinds of things that many of us would think, if that happened to me, it would break me. And those folks not only self-report feeling happier, but they often report that these traumatic events give them meaning in life, they've shaped the purpose, they've strengthened their social connection. And so I think the idea that we have to change something about our circumstances to be happier just doesn't fit with the research. And you know, that's often the thing we go to when we think about what we should do to become happier.
Now that's interesting. I mean, it takes us directly into sort of personal circumstance and anecdote, but I feel I ought to backtrack a little bit. I mean, are you regarding this as a scientific enterprise and a scientific study you're undertaking? Because I know you've set up something called the Happiness Lab, which makes me think of sort of experiments and test tubes and all that sort of stuff. Is this science?
Yeah, I mean, it's often funny to think about, you know, happiness science, as it were, because it feels like the kind of thing that should be relegated to, I don't know, philosophy or religion. But there is a way to take a scientific approach to happiness and to mental health generally. And this is what this field that I study, this field of positive psychology, tends to do. It's pretty straightforward. You know, researchers go out and they find happy people. You know, they're out there, even in the middle of COVID, you can find folks who self-report being happy. And then you do some like quick anthropology, right? How do these folks spend their time? What are they doing that's different than the rest of us are doing? And that's when you get into the experiments. Now you take people who self-report being not so happy. You have them try out the habits and behaviors of the people who are happier, and you test empirically whether or not that improves their well-being. We now have like 3 decades worth of work that's done this and found, you know, simple habits that will actually make folks happier.
Right, but I'm already seeing some problems here, because you're talking about empirical evidence and data gathering and all that sort of stuff, and it does sound very scientific. But the truth is, the very concept of happiness itself is so subjective and means different things to different people. So when you go out and do your field work and you ask Mr. Jones if he's happy, he may say, yeah, I really am. And Mrs. Jones may say she's not. And it's very hard to be scientific about one's feeling as against the others. How are you defining happiness?
Yeah, well, I totally agree with you. I mean, I came to the work in happiness from work in animal behavior, where we have these like incredibly careful measures, you know, often involving hormones and things that feel just much more objective than like a subjective self-report of whether or not you're feeling happy. But I've come around to the work in this field for a couple reasons. One is that the self-report measures that researchers use have been validated over now decades to try to get really accurate answers and really accurate information about how people are feeling. We also know that these self-report measures correlate with all the stuff we expect them to correlate. You know, so if Mr. Jones says, you know, I'm feeling happy today, that will correlate with if I pulled all his social media tweets or I pulled his journals and did a detailed textual analysis about the emotional words he's using. It'll correlate with, say, if I interview Mrs. Jones and say, hey, how's Mr. Jones doing? And do a kind of detailed memory recollection with the people in Mr. Jones's life, his self-reports will correlate with that. And in cases where we have good hormonal measures of happiness and well-being, we don't often, but in cases where we do, those kinds of self-reports correlate with those other kind of more objective measures. And so, you know, what seems like a kind of cheesy, you know, my students call it like a BuzzFeed quiz, like is actually a real scientific instrument that we're using. But I've actually come around to it for a different reason, which is this question of what are we trying to maximize with all these interventions? You know, I'm sure on this show we'll talk about different habits you can use to boost your well-being, but what am I trying to do when I boost your well-being? Well, honestly, what I'm trying to do, at least me personally, is I'm trying to get you to say, hey, I'm feeling happier now. You know, I'm experiencing more positive emotion. I'm feeling more joy. If you tell me that, then whatever intervention I was doing is probably working.
We will get to that. But before we get there, there's one other interesting aspect of your research work that intrigues me. We've talked so far in the context of COVID and all the challenges and difficulties that presents to people and their mental health. But I am very aware that you began this work long before the COVID pandemic. And I think what really motivated you was your realization as a senior professor at one of the best universities, Ivy League universities in the United States, that a lot of the students you were meeting and working with, the student body itself, was getting more miserable. There was more signs of stress, anxiety, and even chronic depression. So why, in your view, are these kids in one of America's elite universities showing such signs of unhappiness and depression?
When you ask college students today about their depression levels, their anxiety levels, and so on, and you compare that with what was happening 5 years ago, 10 years ago, what you find is that today the rates have just gone through the roof. Rates of depression, for example, have doubled since 2009. Right now, college students report being overwhelmingly anxious at rates of like 65%. So almost two-thirds of college students are saying they're overwhelmingly anxious. And this maps onto some really scary mental health behavior. Right now, nationally in the US, 12% of college students report having seriously considered suicide in the last year.
Why? What is going on?
I mean, that is the million-dollar question, right? I mean, there's a lot of finger-pointing, right? We finger-point towards technology and phones and things like social media. You know, we finger point to the fact that, you know, college and the act of getting into college is such a like professional business for students now, you know, where we even have like, you know, daycare centers reporting like their college statistics, you know, for four-year-olds about whether or not that daycare is going to help students get in. And so I think there's a lot more pressure on students that folks have never faced. But the real, you know, what's the smoking gun of where those statistics are coming from, like why we're seeing such change so quickly? I think we're still trying to figure that out.
And is it too early to add on to that bedrock of rising unhappiness any sort of assessment of how much more damage is being done by COVID and all that comes with it, the isolation, the economic insecurity, the uncertainty about what the future holds, of course, as well, the health worries about friends and family. What extra level of stress, anxiety, depression is being added by COVID-19? Can you assess that?
Yeah, well, I mean, this is, you know, the kind of thing researchers are looking at now with, you know, current surveys of college students, you know, adults all over the place. And, you know, the results there are pretty grim, too. I mean, if you had designed a disease that was like specifically figured out to wreck our mental health, COVID would be it, right? You know, it destroys our social connection. It makes it hard to connect with the friends and family members that we care about. It destroys our very routines. You know, we are creatures of habit. You know, part of our safety and well-being comes from the sort of daily routines. Those are all upended. And we don't know when it's going to end. You know, humans hate uncertainty, right? And we've created this disease where it's like, well, we're in lockdown. It's only 2 weeks and we're out. Oh, nope, we're back in lockdown, right? Like those continued changes, that continued uncertainty, all of that is awful for our anxiety and general mental health.
Do you think it's getting worse? I mean, of course, in the background, we have the great hope that comes with vaccines. But in the meantime, there's talk of new mutant variants. There's fear that the vaccines may not be the panacea we all hope they'll be. Do you get a sense that in sort of the second wave and the second lockdown and maybe the third in some countries that we're experiencing, that mental health problems are getting significantly worse over time?
I mean, that's what a lot of people are self-reporting, right? I mean, I think when this first started, at least in the US, you know, when we first went into lockdown, it was, you know, oh, this is kind of cool. I'm with my family. I'm baking bread. You know, people kind of came up with new hobbies and things. I think on like lockdown number three or four, like we're getting sick of this. You know, I think especially in the US right now, we're coming up on this anniversary of March when everyone started taking this really seriously. And I think that's a really scary anniversary because people thought like, okay, I can handle this for a month, but trying to handle it for a year and an indefinite amount of time after this year, I think that, you know, it's a real significant challenge.
Look, Professor Santos, I may be a little unfair to you now, but I'm going to try very briefly and hopefully less than a minute to try and give a real reduced version of what your key pointers are to being happier. It is about, you say, being more social, being grateful and giving thanks, living in the moment, resting, that is sleeping and exercising in the way that your body needs you to, and lastly, being kind. Now, all of those things I can totally relate to. They sound deeply positive and sensible, but frankly, they also sound like plain old common sense. Do you need a science lab to come up with all of that?
I think yes and no, right? I mean, no, in the sense that these kinds of practices are part of ancient traditions. You know, these were the things that Aristotle was suggesting. These are the things that many of our world's religious traditions were suggesting. Things like gratitude and taking time for presence and prayer, doing kind things for others. You know, so in that sense, like these practices are thousands of years old. You know, you might not have needed my class to figure them out, but how many of us are doing them? You know, how many of your listeners right now got the amount of sleep that they needed last night? Or really tried to take a moment to think of what they're grateful for in this challenging time, or took 10 minutes to meditate and be present, right? I mean, our traditions have been telling us this for a long time, but I think two things have happened. One is these practices are hard, right? We need the sort of habits and the rituals to allow us to do them. But the second thing is our intuitions tell us other stuff is going to work. You know, yeah, my religion might have told me to take some time to be grateful, but you know, I want to buy that new phone. Like that'll be what really makes me happy. So I think we're constantly pushing against our intuitions, which lead us astray.
But I'm just thinking to myself, even as you talk, telling people that they should sleep 8 hours a night and that they've got to find ways of doing that, for those who struggle with that, it's probably just going to make them feel even worse. You know, there is something about this sort of science of happiness and the whole sort of happiness industry, which seems to me teeters on the brink of making everybody feel a little bit inadequate. And actually, the more they read, the more unhappy they become.
Well, that's not, I mean, it's not what we're seeing in our classes, right? I mean, we definitely in our classes are seeing that, you know, over time, as you learn the evidence for this, and as you learn how to put these practices into effect in effective ways. And those effective ways involve taking baby steps and involve some self-compassion. It's not kind of turning yourself into your own happiness project. Like that's going to be, you know, probably a recipe for unhappiness.
That's what I'm trying to say, that aren't you part of a happiness industry which thrives on the truth that actually most of us have discontents and dissatisfactions in our life. And if we didn't, your industry would no longer exist.
Well, I think it's a bit of a caricature in the sense that one of the things that this type of approach is doing, taking a scientific approach, I mean, I can't speak for the woo and the wellness industry, you know, the happiness complex is very large. What we're trying to do with a scientific approach is to ask empirically what works, right? And what we see what works is, again, not kind of doing a million of these different strategies at once. When you give the kind of big list, it feels like, okay, I got to sleep and gratitude and so on. When you actually engage in these practices, when you take the class, what you see is we try to break it down into baby steps. We try to allow you to have some self-compassion. So, okay, you didn't sleep great last night. What can you do today? You know, in the 5 minutes you have, the 10 minutes you have, to do a little bit better. And I think that sort of approach is so important in the context of the pandemic. You know, this is not a great time. Like this is not a time when we're going to start, you know, massive self-improvements in the middle of us feeling so burnt out and so busy and so anxious. But there are little things that each of us can do on the edges to improve.
Let me quote to you David Robson. He's a well-known science writer who's also addressed this issue of how to feel better. He says, over the past 10 years, numerous studies have shown that our growing obsession with happiness and high personal confidence may be making us less content in our lives and less effective at reaching our actual goals. Indeed, he says, we may often be happier when we stop focusing on happiness altogether. Has he got a bit of a point there?
It kind of gets back to what we were talking about earlier, which is this definition of happiness, right? I think in the lay public, you get this idea that happiness is like happiness emojis, you know, these yellow smiley faces, you know, perfect emotions all the time. And none of us are going to achieve that, right? You know, I'm the professor who teaches this stuff, and I don't achieve that like pretty much 99% of the time, right?
Well, I do have to ask you, how happy are you? I mean, really, because if this isn't just about fleeting moments of joy, but about achieving a sort of plateau, a level of real satisfaction and contentment with your life, are you there?
There's always room for improvement, but I'm much better than I was, right? I mean, again, you know, these kinds of standard self-report surveys that I make my students do and that my subjects do, I take them myself, you know, so I kind of try to monitor and stay abreast of how things are going. And on average, since before I started this work on a sort of 10-point happiness scale, my happiness is up about a point. Point or two. Now, you know, am I perfectly happy? Am I 100% all the time? No, because that's not what you'd want to be, actually. And I think this is what we get wrong about happiness. We think happiness has to be perfect emotion all the time. But if you look at what happy, you know, quote unquote happy people really do, people who self-report being happy most of the time, they experience negative emotions. They allow them. They have room for anxiety and stress and anger and frustration sometimes, right? But they have the right strategies to either allow those emotions or to find other more positive emotions.
Yeah, no, that is a very interesting point, because I was reflecting, you know, preparing for our chat, I was reflecting on my own life and the life of friends and family. And it seems to me that sadness and also deep frustrations in life and wrong turns taken and regret, all of these things are actually not only part of the human condition, but they're also in many ways positive drivers of ourselves to change, to do things better, to learn.
When you take a scientific approach, you want those negative emotions. Those negative emotions are what cause growth. Those negative emotions are what cause you to recognize what's meaningful in life, or they cause you to sort of increase your social connection. There's a lot of new work on what's called post-traumatic growth. You know, we've all heard of post-traumatic stress, but the researchers show that sometimes going through the awful events make you more resilient in life. We wouldn't want to get rid of those, because part of the true resilience we have, part of the true joy and gratitude we have for good circumstances, has to come from the dark times too.
Let me ask you about our online lives, because you alluded to it earlier talking about young people, but it's not just young people, it's all of us. I'm ashamed to say I got a report on my phone just today telling me that I, over the last week, had spent an average of almost 4 hours a day on my screen. I mean, I feel like putting myself in the sin bin as a result, but that's the reality of so many of our lives, particularly during the pandemic and during lockdowns, which affect so many countries. Do you think online, on-screen life is a negative factor when we talk about collective happiness today?
We can't sort of think in black and white terms. It's not like our technology use is negative or it's good. It's kind of how it's affecting us and what we're doing with it. And that is one of the messages that we teach in the course that people need to pay attention to. You know, in that big list of online hours that you were spending on your phone, I could ask you, okay, which of those were good? You know, some of those you might have been talking to your family members or your friends who you can't see during lockdown. That was probably pretty positive. You know, maybe scrolling through a social media site or, you know, just like looking at dumb stuff on the internet, maybe that didn't feel so good. And one of the things I teach my students comes from a journalist, Catherine Price. She has a wonderful book called How to Break Up with Your Phone. And she uses this WWW acronym, where she asks, when you're interacting with your phone, ask yourself these three W questions: what for, why now, and what else? You know, what did you pick up your phone for? If it was to call, you know, your mom, great. You know, that was a specific purpose. If it was because you're just kind of anxious and bored and it was sort of rote, maybe, you know, not as good. And, you know, why now? Did you need to pick up your phone? Was there something specific? Or was it just kind of, you know, habit that may or may not be good? And what else? I think that's the question that we need to be asking ourselves right now. You know, before the pandemic times, I would remember going to restaurants and seeing whole families sitting around the table together looking at their phones. Even during the pandemic times, I think, you know, sometimes I'm doing Zoom calls with friends, but I could be like hanging out with my husband who lives with me, you know, really connecting, right? But if you're using it for good and when you pay attention mindfully, it feels good, it's building you up, great. But, you know, those behaviors that you're doing that aren't feeling so good, maybe you can replace them with something better.
Now, I'm mindful that you're talking to me from one of the best universities in the United States, is Yale. Everything we've discussed over the last few minutes, some might say, you know what, this is just such a classic first world problem, first world discussion. You know, in so many parts of the world, they're not sort of sitting around wondering about how they can be happier. They're just actually getting on with life, putting bread on the table, worrying about whether they'll have a job next week. And that overrides and is so much more important than any of the stuff you and me have talked about today.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, this actually, I think, is another common misconception about happiness. You know, I actually, one of my first lectures for my students is the question, is happiness a first world problem? And one of the things we look at is just like, what's the causal arrow of happiness? Again, we sometimes think, you know, good circumstances happen, we're making a lot of money, and then all of a sudden we get happy. But actually, if you look at the research, there's evidence that the causal arrow points the other way too, that happiness, whether it's defined as cheerfulness, a positive outlook on life, a sense of meaning, actually contributes to some of those better circumstances. One of the most striking findings is if you look at an individual's cheerfulness at 18, that actually predicts their salary at age 27. It predicts their job performance, and it also predicts something about their, like, the way they like their job and their sort of job expectations and how happy they are with their jobs. There's also evidence that if you look at people's level of positive attitude or positive outlook, that actually predicts in some senses their immune function. So you can expose people, one study actually exposed folks to rhinoviruses. These days we're always talking about coronaviruses. Rhinoviruses are the virus that causes the common cold. And they looked at, after being exposed, who got infected. And what they find is a small but significant effect of your positive outlook on life. If you tend to be kind of somebody with that kind of high positive outlook, you feel joy and laughter all the time, you're less likely to catch these colds than folks with a sort of lower positive outlook on life. We think that like all these good things happen and you're happier, but it could be that we have the causal arrow backwards. You know, maybe if we focused on well-being and resilience and positive outlook on life, some of the things we really care about, like job obtainment, you know, health and things like that, maybe those things would fall into line better than we think.
As a psychologist, do you believe that it's time for countries around the world to stop being so obsessed with GDP, gross domestic product, and be much more concerned, as they are in the country of Bhutan, with gross national happiness? And I ask that mindful that the United States, where you live and work, the most powerful economy in the world, is slowly sinking down the UN's World Happiness Index. I think it's now at number 19, and the top countries are North European, Finland, Denmark, Switzerland, Iceland, and Norway. Is there a message here about how governments and, you know, public policy are designed to best deliver collective happiness?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's something important there. I think, you know, implicit in a lot of the ways we design, you know, capitalist structures and governments and these things are these intuitions we have about what's going to mean for a good life, you know, a well-lived life. My hope is that that's what governments are going for, right? You know, the maximal number of people getting a well-lived life. And those intuitions, the research suggests, might be wrong. You know, they're much more money-bound than the actual evidence suggests. And so, yes, I think countries do need to focus on GDP, you know, if they have a lot of people living below the poverty line. Like, we know if you can't put a roof over your head, on food on your table, that level of financial insecurity is definitely going to affect your well-being. But above a certain point, like, just focusing on money isn't going to affect your happiness in the way we assume, right? You know, there's lots of evidence that, you know, once you get to a certain level, you don't necessarily need any more money. You need other things. And I think this is a spot where governments can really take effect. You know, there's a lot of evidence that when governments invest in things like spaces for social connection, spaces for exercise, when governments invest in sort of protecting people's time a little bit so people can get some free time back, you know, all of those kinds of things can actually improve people's well-being over time. And that's what some of these Nordic countries are doing really quite successfully.
Well, Professor Laurie Santos, we have to end there, but it has made me very happy that you could join me on Hard Talk today. Thank you very much indeed.
Thanks so much for having me.